loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we have our regular Friday political segment with Lukman Nation. U.S. politics keeps getting weirder and weirder. We'll talk about races in South Carolina, Ohio, and Florida, among others. And then we talk with Professor Andreas Malm about his new environmental book called The Progress of the Storm. In it, he addresses the environmental crisis caused by climate change and how humanity can step back from the brink.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the trade war with China widened today as President Trump announced new 25% tariffs on $50 billion of Chinese products. He also said that he's considering tariffs on another $16 billion worth of Chinese goods. The Chinese retaliated almost immediately. Next, fallout continues over the release yesterday of the FBI Inspector General's report, with President Trump pouncing on the finding of insubordination on the part of former FBI Director James Comey and calling Comey and former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe scum. The president also said that the FBI under Barack Obama was a den of thieves. The IG also found that Comey used a private email account for government business. Commentators are saying today that the report will likely only further polarize the country. Then the leader of the Pakistani Taliban has reportedly been killed in a U.S. airstrike. Mullah Fazlullah became leader of the group in 2013, and his death would mark another turn as the war drags on in Afghanistan and northwest Pakistan. And then the House of Representatives is considering what it calls a compromise bill that would give visas to Dreamers, those people who were brought to the United States as children with their undocumented parents. The bill, though, is a disaster. It would not allow any path to citizenship for Dreamers and makes it a crime to earn less than 125% of the federal poverty level. The bill would eliminate the green card lottery, cut family immigration to the bone, and virtually end asylum request approvals. And finally, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. And in other headlines, today a federal judge sent political operative Paul Manafort to await trial from jail. After being indicted on financial conspiracy charges, he was then issued another indictment for witness tampering. This last indictment was levied while he was out on bail. His trial is scheduled for September. Sao Paulo's VTV television station has brought on a new commentator for the World Cup. It's former Brazilian president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and he's currently in jail. He'll submit written commentary to VTV, and the show will post his comments in quotes on the screen during the show. The host of the show is José Trajano, former director of ESPN Brazil. The first episode with Lula's comments will air on Monday after Brazil's first game against Switzerland. The man who attacked Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was sentenced to 30 days in jail today. René Boucher, Paul's next-door neighbor, pled guilty to felony assault on a member of Congress. The incident, which took place last November, was apparently motivated by a dispute over the lawn of their adjacent properties. The CEO of French car manufacturing giant Renault has announced that the company would not pull out of Iran, but floated the possibility that the firm would downsize very strongly. In reference to the new sanctions imposed by the Trump administration following its withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, the CEO of Renault said, quote, "We will be watching closely to make sure our presence in Iran does not provoke direct or indirect reprisal measures on the part of American authorities," unquote. Iran is struggling to maintain its access to the world economy in the face of the U.S. government's offensive against it. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion on the nation's politics and where the midterms are headed. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our weekly update about the 2018 midterm elections. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Hey, thank you.
So there's been a number of developments. Of course, there were primary elections on Tuesday. What's your biggest takeaway for the week?
My biggest takeaway for the week is that because of the North Korean summit, North Korean agreement, the deal that with no there, it doesn't matter that there are no details in this deal. The thing that's important for Trump's base is that they see him as accomplishing something that previous administrations couldn't, didn't, wouldn't. The details don't matter to them. And this deal with North Korea is basically the foundation for these midterm elections really being referendums in Trump's base's mind, that if these Republicans aren't Trump supporters, they're not going to vote for them. And that we're already seeing them. We're already seeing that in some of these races.
Yeah. What do you think, John? Is this becoming a more like nationalized election?
I think it is becoming a nationalized election. And if you look at the polls, check out realclearpolitics.com. We are also more and more divided as a nation. So the Democrats, all the generic Democratic versus Republican polls show the Democrats with a slight lead to a moderate lead, say from 2 points to 8 points. You need to get up to 12 or 13 points for it to be a landslide and to probably flip the House. But I think people are really entrenching right now. The people who would vote for Donald Trump are going to vote for Republicans. And those who don't like Donald Trump are going to vote for Democrats. It's all going to come down to turnout. And turnout normally is depressed in an off-year election. So really, it all depends on getting out the vote. You know, who can get their voters to the polls better than the other side?
I'm kind of two minds on that, because on the one hand, you can kind of see why people would want to vote in this election more so than in other ones, because, you know, the pace of political developments has been so rapid, and people are, you know, very outraged at a lot of the things that the Trump administration is doing. And on the other side, you know, Trump has been able to maintain this like very hardcore of support. But on the other hand, I mean, I think there's also an undercurrent of U.S. public opinion that's just kind of disgusted with politics and don't really see still see sort of like the fundamental sameness of all the politicians, as opposed to seeing this as like a real, like, you know, serious choice. What do you think?
I agree. I think that is probably going to be a bigger problem for the Democrats than the Republicans, because even in midterm elections, Republican voters, which are usually a pretty solid, retired, upper middle class kind of electorate, usually come out in Republican primaries at a pretty decent rate. That's not always true of Democrats, of Democratic voters. And we saw this in California, where the turnout was really low in the Democratic primaries. And I think that is going to be a big factor for Democrats coming up to the rest of the primary races. I don't think voters are excited. Voters aren't excited about any candidates, I don't think. I think you're right, Walter. But I think for the Democrats, If all they've got is not Trump, resist Trump, then people really are not excited about that at all.
I'm going to agree in part and disagree in part.
Okay.
I think you're right about the anti-Trump being a losing strategy. You've got to stand for something. You can't just stand against everything. You can't just say vote for me because I hate Trump. On the other hand, if you look at some of the numbers in Virginia, you're right about California and turnout. It was ridiculously low, inexcusably
abysmal.
Low. But it was much higher in Virginia. For example, Corey Stewart, who is going to be or is now the Republican nominee to challenge Tim Kaine for the Senate, got 132,000 votes. Well, the last time he ran for the Senate, he got 155,000 votes and lost. So that tells me that the Republicans, at least in Virginia, are going to have a very serious problem getting their voters to the polls.
Well, Virginia is, and you're right, you're absolutely right, but Virginia is really interesting. That race is fascinating because there has been a long simmering battle over the Confederate monuments in Virginia.
Yes, indeed.
And Corey Stewart has ties, public ties to white supremacists.
And he makes no apologies for it.
He makes no apologies for it. He is a staunch supporter of keeping all Confederate symbolism. So he's not even popular in the Virginia GOP.
No.
They're actually very unhappy that he won.
In fact, the former lieutenant governor, Republican lieutenant governor Bill Bowling, endorsed mm-hmm. Tim Kaine during the course of the week, just because Stewart is such a right-wing extremist.
Yes, and I think the Republican senatorial committee isn't sure if they're gonna. They have not come out and said they're going to endorse him. Because he's, which is a big deal.
And even if they do endorse him in the end, they're not going to give him any money.
They're not going to give him a dime because they really need to distance themselves from the racists and the whack jobs that are running and winning. So, yeah, Virginia is very interesting because it's one of those states where candidates can win on those kinds of wedge issues at the right time. And this just happened. He just struck lightning in a bottle for because he's tried before. And people were very reticent to openly support him as much. But now not so much because the political and the social tide has changed because I think Trumpism really has lended credibility to these voices. So now these people are, they're like, fine, yeah, he hangs out with white supremacists. Great.
They feel empowered.
Exactly.
I want to ask you also about some of these House races. A lot of women were nominated on the Democratic side in Virginia. There's one race in particular I wanted to get your take on, and this is the 7th District. Dave Brat is the incumbent. Dave Brat's the guy who defeated Eric Cantor in the Republican primary several years ago. Eric was the majority whip. And was going on to great things in politics until he was unceremoniously thrown out. But the woman who won the Democratic nomination is Abigail Spanberger. She's a former CIA officer and a former federal law enforcement officer. She is conservative, and this district is changing its boundaries. And so where practically yesterday this was a very safe Republican district, it's north of Richmond. All of a sudden, it's not. Where's this race going?
Who knows? I think that because of the gerrymandering that we're continuing to see, we're continuing to have problems with boundary changing. This is confusing voters as to where they're supposed to vote, who they're voting for. That's going to be a factor in this election. Her law enforcement credentials should be troubling, but because she's conservative and Virginia is not Northern Virginia outside of D.C.
There are two Virginias.
Right.
Without a doubt.
Exactly. So to think that this is an area that we should just, well, of course, she's not going to win because she's such a conservative. In that area of the state, we can't say that. So I think that it's going to stay pretty safely red. I really do. I don't think Virginia's boundaries changing in any district is really going to change the character, the red character of the House seats. I think that's a couple of years of hard work by Democrats.
I agree with that. It's not so easy to flip something that has always been of one ideology. Just like that with the snap of a finger.
Yeah, and Virginia really is one of those states, and there are a lot of historical reasons for that. Some of them are pretty obvious, but we have to push out of our minds that Virginia is like Alexandria. There's a completely different electorate.
Completely different
than somewhere north or south of Richmond.
Yeah, it changes. Right about at Fredericksburg.
Yes.
And then south
exactly.
of Fredericksburg, it's completely red. North of Fredericksburg, it's completely blue. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it's worked out over the last 20 years or so.
Yeah. And I really do think it's going to stay that way.
We can't do this segment without talking about Mark Sanford in South Carolina. Wow. I watched this race from the beginning to the ugly, bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have a guy. We talked about him a little bit earlier this week on Wednesday. Here you have a guy who was a congressman.
Mm-hmm.
He became governor of South Carolina, two terms, very popular. One day he released a press release saying that he was going to go hiking on the Appalachian Trail and he would be out of touch for a while. Well, a reporter saw him in Atlanta Airport returning from Buenos Aires, Argentina, where he had gone to visit his girlfriend. His wife threw him out, and he was no longer governor. He hung on to the end. He didn't resign.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
But he was essentially ruined, or at least that's what everybody thought. He worked to rehabilitate his reputation, and he ran for Congress again, and he won.
And he won.
Yeah, how did he do that? I truly don't know. I mean, that's a serious question. Why do you think he was able
to do
that?
Because he took the heat. He accepted the heat over this affair. Just like the baseball player Wade Boggs. Sanford said, yep, I did it. I shouldn't have done it, but I did. I don't love my wife anymore. I love this other woman. I screwed up my life.
I hope
people forgive me. And they did. They forgave him.
Uh-huh.
And in a state and a district where there really is no Democratic Party, it doesn't count for anything. All he had to do was win a primary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what he did.
He had the name recognition. He had the money. It was his old district. And so he won.
Yeah. And I think Sanford's story, that part of his story, exposes the longstanding hypocrisy of the moral majority, family values,
totally.
Kind of, you know, because
totally. But it's not a unique story. It happens all
not
the time.
And exactly. And if you see these stories, if you pay attention to them, you would have known that this family values business was bull hockey a long time ago.
Well, he, for whatever reason, he became probably Donald Trump's biggest detractor in the Republican Party among elected officials.
Very vocal.
Very vocal, anti-Trump. You remember during the campaign, there was quite a large Never Trump movement, it was called, hashtag Never Trump. And there were a lot of very important, very senior Republican leaders who called themselves a part of that movement. Well, most of them have come around. Sanford didn't come around. And so Katie Arrington, who is a state representative in South Carolina, challenged Sanford from the right.
Mm-hmm.
And she just wiped him out.
Yes, she did.
He only got 46%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is going back to what I said about Trump's base using his appearance of success with this North Korea deal as a referendum on politicians who support Trump, whether they support Trump or not. This is one of those examples.
It is.
I think this is one of those examples.
What Trump did in this case was he stayed out of it until there were 3 hours left.
Yes, he did, until the very end.
And then he tweeted an endorsement of Arrington, and that pushed her right across the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we saw the same. We're seeing the same thing in other races where the anti-Trump contingent of the Republican Party now has moved over to, okay, maybe Trump a little bit.
Right.
You know, Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney's doing exactly the same thing. Here's Mitt Romney, who's the anti-Trump,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he can't even win a Republican convention in his own state. And so he has to go to a primary, and he's going to win the primary. But he has to be reassessing how anti-Trump he's going to be able to be once he gets to the U.S. Senate.
And I think that shows like sort of what's at the core of this anti-Trump or quote never Trump sentiment among people who would, you know, self-describe as conservatives. It's not because they're opposed to like his virulent racism and anti-immigrant and blah, blah, blah.
Not at all.
No, it's because he's not seen as like a competent manager of the empire. You know, like
exactly.
Because Mitt Romney wants to, I mean, the rumor is that he wants to be on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He
mm-hmm.
wants to be sort of
mm-hmm.
a foreign policy advisor. So he's like, well, look, if I can right the ship in terms of foreign and military policy, then
right.
who cares about all the other stuff?
Exactly. I mean, and he's not the only one. We're talking about politicians who have, rather than run against the swelling pro-Trump tide, who are part of the anti-Trump contingent, who decided they're just not gonna run for re-election anymore, like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker. Now, Corker, I'll give a little bit of latitude to, because Corker is a little bit older. So, and he's been at this for a long time, and he probably is just tired. So,
yeah, but not running for re-election,
he can say anything he wants. But Jeff Flake, honestly, these are people who are supposed to have been the stalwarts for the stalwart defenders of American values, and they're giving up. Some of them are just giving up because they can't fight against this populist in the worst way tide of Trump support. It's very troubling for the Republican Party.
Let's talk about trouble for the Democrats in Florida.
Mm.
The Florida
mm-hmm.
Senate race. Now, this is going to be, it's shaping up to be the most expensive Senate race in the history of the country.
Wow.
They're looking at spending about $250 million between the two of them for a job that pays 200 grand.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. It's all about the power. So you've got an incumbent senator, Bill Nelson. And he's the Democrat, and
mm-hmm.
he's being challenged by the relatively popular Republican governor, Rick Scott. Now, Rick Scott is controversial because he's a pretty hard right Republican. He wanted to throw people off of Medicaid, for example. He doesn't want to expand Medicare. He actually turned down hurricane relief money because he said that federal taxes should be lower. He's going to do his part by not accepting federal aid.
Wow.
Which is nuts.
What that's ridiculous, especially considering the situation in Florida because of Hurricane Maria.
That's right. And the thing about Rick Scott, too, is that he's so rich. He can't even count all his money. He's a self-made multi-millionaire. And so if he wanted to, he could self-finance this race.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bill Nelson doesn't have any money. Bill Nelson has been in the Senate for a long time, and he's comfortable, maybe a little bit lazy in terms of campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't think he was going to have a problem. Well, every single poll shows Nelson losing this race.
Yep.
As unpopular as Rick Scott can be, and he goes up and down over and under 50%, it looks like he's going to win this thing.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we talk about this almost every week, if not every other week. It comes down to campaign. It comes down
sure
to campaigning because of Hurricane Maria, the Puerto Rican population of Florida has swelled. And
yes.
And it's interesting that they are, and I did not know they were spending upwards of $250 million for this campaign.
It's pretty crazy.
When that money could have gone to Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yes.
That's ironic and probably the most obscene way I can think of. But the fact that Rick Scott has already produced campaign ads for people that he didn't want to accept federal funds for hurricane relief for in Spanish, television and radio ads. And I read, I think maybe in Politico that he's learning Spanish so he can do Spanish language interviews.
Crazy.
All to,
actually not crazy. Very
actually
smart.
Not crazy. Crazy like a fox.
Yeah, crazy like a fox.
That's right.
All to get the votes of people who he didn't want to accept federal aid to help.
That's right.
While Bill Nelson hasn't done any of those things. He doesn't have. He has one Spanish language ad coming out. I think his campaign released a press conference saying that we're working on a Spanish language ad.
You know, and this is that conceit
mm-hmm.
that he thinks he thought at least that he was going to win just because he's Bill Nelson.
Right.
You know, he probably calculated that he's worked very hard over the last, decade and a half. And people like him. He's popular. So there's no reason to campaign. Well, he didn't think he was going to have to raise $125 million to keep his seat.
Right. Right. Exactly. And I think he thought because of the situation with Puerto Rico and the people who are now living in Florida, he thought that he could get the endorsement of the, I think it's the father of the current governor of Puerto Rico, because he endorsed Nelson. But then the representative, the congressional representative for Puerto Rico, the current congressional representative for Puerto Rico, who doesn't have a vote. Puerto Rico is exactly like the District of Columbia as far as Congress is concerned. They have a representative who doesn't have a valid vote. That person, Jennifer Gonzalez, I think her name is, endorsed Rick Scott. So I think Bill Nelson thought, I think you're right, John, that Nelson thought, hey, you know, I've been doing this a long time. People mm-hmm. like me. I've been doing a good job. And hey, look, the father of the current governor of Puerto Rico has endorsed me. And that's not going to help him. None of that is going to help him.
No, it's not going to help at all.
No.
And
that's unfortunate. This is one of those examples of the Democrats being very unaware of the missed opportunity they have to win an election where they can hold on to this seat, but they're going to lose it because they think that, well, people should know that this is just the right candidate to vote for. That's not the case.
If the Democrats don't want to have their hats handed to them in this next election, they have to hold this seat. They have to hold all of their endangered seats.
Yes.
We've talked about this. West Virginia, Indiana, Montana, Missouri, Florida. Well, if Florida goes, well, Missouri might go, Montana might go, Indiana might go. And then what do you have? You have almost a Republican supermajority in in the Senate.
That's right. This Florida is very troubling.
I want to talk about the Supreme Court decision this week that allows the state of Ohio to purge its voter rolls. So what Ohio did is the state enacted a rule where if you haven't voted in the last 2 years, they send you a notice saying, hey, you didn't vote, so you have to vote. And if you don't vote again for two more years, they just throw you off the voter rolls. Several citizens sued saying that, you know, once you're registered, you're registered.
Right.
If you haven't moved,
right,
it's your right to either vote or not vote.
That's what a right is.
Well, the Supreme Court was sharply divided on this. The vote was 5-4,
mm-hmm.
and they sided with the state of Ohio. Well, we all know that it's mostly minorities and poor people who skip elections. And so these people are going to go to the polls and they're going to realize that they're not even registered to vote. And that potentially could flip Ohio.
Yes, it could. And of course, the people who are behind this decision are celebrating because they're the Republicans who want to win these seats. They don't want minorities and poor people to vote. But I can't entirely blame the Republicans either, because this is also the Democrats' fault for, like we said a few weeks ago, not having offices in, not having a 50-state strategy where they are constantly pushing their brand, whatever that is right now, who knows, but where they're not constantly pushing their brand everywhere and giving voters a reason to want to vote in every election.
Yes.
The Republicans are always, for good or bad, for even though their ideology is really messed up these days and has been in the past, Republicans are always campaigning. And I think that's just very true. And always raising money. They're always doing outreach. Democrats have fallen down on the job for that, especially in minority and poor neighborhoods. And that's why people don't vote.
I'm going to interrupt you on that point. I can't let you go without talking about the pimp who won a nomination in Nevada. Tell us about that. He's an actual pimp.
He is an actual pimp. Dennis Hoff, he wrote a book called The Art of the Pimp. He really did. He owns brothels. He called the Love Ranch, I think. I am guilty of actually watching the show that he had on HBO, at least for like a half a season, because I thought, this can't be real. No, this is real. He ran as a libertarian 3 years ago. Last year, ran a campaign, Hookers for Hillary. yes. And this year ran as a Republican and won, seeing the Trump swell, and seized on the opportunity and has won. And now he's going to face Democrat Lizia Romanoff in the general election. Who knows how that's going to go? But I can't stop harping on the fact that these are the people of alleged family values. No disrespect to sex
only
workers.
Only in America.
But yeah.
we're going to leave it there. We've been joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The Progress of This Storm is a new and powerful book by Andreas Malm. In it, he addresses the environmental crisis caused by climate change, its roots in the system of capitalism, and how humanity can step back from the brink. We're joined from Sweden by Andreas Malm. He teaches human ecology at Lund University in Sweden. He's the author of Fossil Capital, Iran on the Brink, and of course, his latest book, The Progress of This Storm. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us about the main argument in your book. I mean, what motivated you to write on this subject? What's the significance of this crisis?
I think it's a crisis that you know, puts everything in question and calls for a rethinking of our categories, our ways of looking upon the world. It really changes everything, as Naomi Klein has it in her book. And I think in some respects it constitutes a kind of return of nature, because nature is something that we have long imagined was dead or was beyond the things that are important to societies, a separate sphere that we could imagine that we were outside of. But now it comes really back into our society. We can just look at the country that I'm living in, Sweden, where we currently have forest fires on a grand scale, something that's pretty unusual in our country. And we have a prolonged drought with serious water scarcities along some parts of the coast. And these are, you know, natural mechanism. When forests get really dry, it's been warm for a long time, they are easily consumed in conflagrations. And this is just one kind of natural mechanism that global warming brings with it and activates. And nature comes kind of roaring back into society and creates all kinds of crises. I think that people that try to grapple with climate change, in particular in academia, often make some theoretical and analytical mistakes. And this latest book I wrote is pretty much an attack on those mistakes. So it's kind of a theoretical essay where I try to chase down certain analytical dead ends and mistakes as I see it. That's not done in the belief that theory is really important, but I do think it can be quite important to try to make sense of what's happening. And I think that people who, for instance, speak of nature as complete social construction or as just something that we invent through our texts and discourses get it wrong, because that kind of obscures the very tangible, material, natural processes that are happening in a warming world.
We're talking with Andreas Malm. He's the author of the new book, The Progress of the Storm. It's about climate change, the crisis facing the environment. Andreas, before we get into some more specifics, let's just talk briefly about, you know, the general framework that you think people should think of this or approach this problem with. Usually we hear politicians or, you know, on the media talking about the environment and the crisis as a matter of personal responsibility, that you should change your consumption patterns in order to, you know, quote, reduce your carbon footprint, or, you know, if you recycle. In other words, if there are individual efforts on the part of the consumers to be more sustainable, then that will be what resolves the climate crisis. But I think what you're arguing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's the system of capitalism itself, that there's an economic model that dominates the world. It's based on constant expansion, right? Like if you're a CEO of a company, you need to make sure that the third quarter's profits are bigger than the second quarter's profits. And if you don't, then you're in trouble because the board of directors might find a new CEO. So even if you have, you know, an individual sympathy towards the environment or towards the climate, the logic of profit itself leads to this never-ending cycle of expansion, which has, you know, the long-term sustainability of the planet. You know, it's just not a factor. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's particularly disastrous when you look at oil corporations or coal companies or the firms, the businesses that actually produce fossil fuels, because their entire business idea and business model is to get those fuels out of the ground and sell them to others who can burn them. And those companies reinvest their profits in even more pipelines, even more oil platforms and harbors for liquefied natural gas, and this constantly expanding infrastructure for extracting and distributing and then burning fossil fuels. And this expansion is happening still regardless of the amount of science that we have indicating that we're running towards the precipice. And regardless of how many middle-class consumers try to behave more eco-friendly when they go shopping. And this expansion of infrastructure that is based on fossil fuels will continue until states decide that we can't do this anymore and we're going to force those investors to stop expanding. And we're going to, for instance, it's an obvious demand, put a moratorium on further coal mines and pipelines and things like that. But still, what you actually see on the ground, from the pipelines being built in Canada to the new airports that are built in Europe, third runway on Heathrow was just announced in London, for instance, is a constant acceleration of this rollout of fossil fuel infrastructure. And that will never be changed by me personally taking a train to London instead of flying, or by me taking my bike as an individual consumer. It can only be changed by states, but they will not do it voluntarily. I think it requires mass mobilization to get the states to make the necessary decisions. And that's what the climate movement is trying to prompt, a kind of mobilization of popular anger against the insanity of continued fossil fuel use. So far, it hasn't reached a critical mass. I hope it can do so. I don't see any other hope, really.
Andreas, I want to ask you about a section of the book that I find to be fascinating, and that is where you talk about the magnification of already existing conflicts. Can you walk us through some of these conflicts? You talk about Darfur, Boko Haram, the Arab Spring, for example. How does climate change exacerbate some of these problems?
I think the clearest case is Syria. It's a controversial case and hotly contested. But I would say that one of the factors in the crisis that led to the outbreak of the Syrian revolution that later morphed into the civil war was a very long and unprecedented drought in the region of Syria and northern Iraq and western Iraq. And that drought caused mass displacement of farmers from the agricultural heartlands in eastern Syria into the cities. And it caused a rise in food prices that put serious strain on people's household economies, budgets. And it was one of the things that began to tear Syrian society apart in the years that eventually ushered in the Syrian uprising. So the way that the climate impacts can intensify social conflicts is that it can remove resources from people who already have very scant resources and put the spotlight on massive inequalities in societies where some people can buffer themselves against those impacts. In this case, they can continue to purchase food even though it's expensive, and they have water to irrigate their lawns and things like that, while poor people can't afford basic food stuff and have to leave their villages in parched parts of the country of Syria as it occurred in 2009, 10, 11. And I think we'll see, all indications are that we'll see more crises of this kind in the near future, because global warming is a destruction of biophysical resources. It entails the destruction of water sources, the inundation of land, the arrival of much fiercer hurricanes than previously, and all kinds of destructive events against which some people will be able to protect themselves, but others will be extremely vulnerable. And this will kind of tear off the veil of equality that some people still believe we have, and show very deep divisions in society. And that makes for, I think, an increased scenario of social conflict.
Andreas, we recently learned that over 4,000 people died in Puerto Rico when the hurricane hit. You know, that's, of course, vastly higher than the, 60-something that the government had previously admitted. It's an unbelievable catastrophe that happened in Puerto Rico. And, of course, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and so you have this intermingling of the climate crisis, hurricanes, the intensification of the hurricane season as a consequence of these physical phenomena, these ecological phenomena that we're seeing, and a very political phenomena, the phenomena of colonialism, led to this huge amount of human suffering. Let's talk about hurricanes for a moment. I mean, how, like, specifically, why does climate change lead to worse storms, worse hurricanes, and how are we seeing that having an impact on society, on like the fabric and cohesiveness of society?
Yeah, so I'm not a meteorologist or a hurricane expert, really, but the basic science is pretty clear, and that's when you have water oceans with high temperatures, you get more energy, more fuel that animates those powerful hurricanes. So when a hurricane forms, it can integrate or draw in more energy from the sea surfaces that is then dissipated through the violence of the hurricane. And you get more intense rainfall with more vapor in the air that you know, warmer air can hold more vapor. And when you also have higher sea levels, the storm surges come in with much greater force and you get more of inundation. And that's what you've seen in the most recent extremely catastrophic hurricane season in the Caribbean, as you just mentioned, that really tore apart and ravaged several islands there. And you know, it's likely that something similar will happen in the next hurricane season later this year or the year thereafter, because the tendency is for these phenomena to escalate. So this is not the new normal, what we saw last year. Rather, the signs are that these things will get worse. And the question for the Caribbean is, will these places be inhabitable in the near future? It's the same question that people are raising about the Middle East and parts of West Asia, where you see so scorching temperatures that people have to stay inside. I mean, this is just playing out in parts of Pakistan in the past few weeks, where the temperatures are so high that they're actually lethal to human bodies. You can't stay outside in those temperatures for any longer period. If you want to survive, so you have to stay inside, and normal life becomes impossible. And in the Caribbean, it so happened that I was on the island of Dominica 6 weeks before Hurricane Maria smashed into the island. I left the island 6 weeks before that. And it was a very strange experience to having been in a country and you know, marveled at its beauty and enjoyed the company of its people. And 6 weeks later, basically the country wasn't there any longer because the hurricane had just blown away the entire forest cover and destroyed all of the infrastructure there. And as you're saying, the people that are suffering most tend to be people that suffered from colonialism and that are poor and vulnerable. They are the ones who bear the brunt of the consequences. This is the fundamental injustice of climate change, and it's going to get worse. That's what it appears like.
And of course, you know, that those dramatic changes in temperatures that you were talking about, I mean, that has a devastating effect on something that's foundational to human civilization, what actually allowed humanity to develop civilization in the first place. And that's agriculture, right? Whether that's, you know, the cultivation of land or fishing, you know, the basic food supplies, the chain of, well, of course, the food, the distribution of food, the production of food is an economic process, right? It's part of the capitalist economic model now, or has become subsumed into it. But that is being disrupted to a great degree, something so fundamental to human life, by the warming world. So, I mean, what does that do to the communities that rely on fishing, that rely on agriculture?
Well, yeah, you see that the immediate impacts on people who rely on agriculture and who have no reserves or buffers, but you will also see massive impacts on people who rely on imported foodstuffs. And the greatest dependence on imported foodstuffs you will find in the Middle East, in countries such as Egypt, that imports more wheat than any other country in the world. And when you get food price shocks because of some supply crisis, such as you had in 2010, when you had extreme droughts in the breadbaskets of Russia and Ukraine and parts of China as well, you get spikes in the food prices, and this translates into very high food prices in those countries, and can push people over the edge into very serious deprivation. So agricultural crisis precipitated by climate change can come both in the form of suffering for the people who are, you know, immediately dependent on what they grow, but also as chain reactions far away from the source, when people who rely on imported food across vast distances suffer the repercussions of the original crisis. And again, I think if things continue as now, we'll see much more of this, unfortunately.
The United Nations, or researchers associated with the United Nations, estimate that there could be up to 1 billion refugees by 2050. And of course, this massive increase in the refugee population would be driven primarily by climate change. Right now, we have, I believe, about 50 million people on the move all around the world, forced out of their homes by war, which, as we've said, is often fueled by climate change itself. By economic deprivation, of course, also fueled by climate change. The political ramifications, if that comes to pass, if there's a billion refugees, many of them climate refugees, in the world, I mean, the destabilization all around the globe would be tremendous, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. I mean, we have to take those predictions with a little bit of caution, because it's hard to tell exactly what the flows will look like. And most of the people who move because of climate change end up pretty close to where they went from. So, for instance, when villages are abandoned in Bangladesh in the Delta because of sea level rise, those people in Bangladesh don't end up in the US or in Sweden. They go to Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, and try to survive as very poor and easily exploited workers in that city.
But Dhaka could be underwater soon, right? I mean, not soon, but, you know, in the future.
There comes a point where those flows will stretch out geographically, and where people will have to try to make it into the still habitable metropolis of the world, the cores of the world system, the US, Japan, Australia, Europe, and so on. And the problem here, of course, is that what we're seeing, particularly on this continent, well, you have the same tendencies in the US, of course, but what we're seeing in this continent, in Europe, and not the least in my own country, Sweden, is an absolute obsession with immigration, where immigrants are demonized to a degree we haven't seen since the interwar period, where all the ills of society are blamed on immigrants who come here from the Middle East and Africa. And it reaches the levels of national psychosis in this country, where it has become the only political question, the only issue that people discuss. While our forests are burning and our glaciers are melting and our coasts are eroding, that's what people worry about, the completely invented threat of immigration. And the risk here is that we'll see larger flows of migration and even higher borders and even more aggressive patrolling of European territory against migrants, as we've just been seeing in the Mediterranean, where Italy has been taken over by a far-right government that does everything now to stop people of the wrong skin color to enter their territory. And we have exactly the same tendency in this country, and that bodes very ill for a future with greater migratory movements of people. The only solution, although it's not a solution, but the only adaptation, the only reasonable adaptation to a warming world where more people will have to move, is to pull down the walls and open the borders and move towards a kind of global citizenship, where people who are displaced due to climate change will have the right to move to safer locations. And this is not the least ethically required, because the people that will have to move suffer from consequences of the actions of rich people in the white affluent parts of the north. The ethical duty in countries such as my own would be to open their borders to people who have become dislocated, displaced because of climate change. But that is not the direction we're going in right now. We're going in the very opposite direction, with reinforced border walls and fences, and a lockdown of the borders and a crackdown on migrants. And this is a pathology that is sweeping this continent. I mean, there's almost no country that is safe from this tendency.
I agree with you. I mean, in the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump made anti-refugee sentiment a main part of his campaign. I mean, despite the fact that the United States, I think, lets in a shamefully small number of refugees, despite being, you know, I think, principally responsible for a lot of the crises that they're fleeing from. We're talking with Andreas Malm. He teaches human ecology at Lund University in Sweden, and he's the author of the new book, The Progress of the Storm, about climate change, global warming, and how it's leading to crises all throughout society. Andreas, I'm so glad that you wrote this book, because the ecological crisis is not something that can just be thought about later or, you know, after there's fundamental change in society. I mean, for people who desire a truly better world, this is a life or death right now kind of issue. And I like reading a lot about this topic, and there are a couple concepts that I wanted to get your thoughts on. One that I read about and I find quite interesting is this idea of a climate debt. So not only is there great inequalities within capitalist societies between rich and poor, in a global order dominated by that economic system, there's great inequality between the developed and the underdeveloped countries, the former colonizing countries and the formerly colonized countries that are struggling to overcome that legacy of underdevelopment. And so the idea basically goes something like this, that there's only so much carbon that the planet can take, right? There's sort of like there's a cap, and the cap, you know, by right belongs to all people who live on the earth. The wealthy countries used up all of that cap, you know, if you sort of envision it as sort of a quota belonging to, you know, each country based on size. You know, the advanced wealthy countries like the United States, countries in Western Europe, used up all of the Earth's carrying capacity for carbon. And so there's a debt. There's basically a monetary debt owed by the rich countries to the underdeveloped countries. What do you think about that? How useful of a concept is that?
It's entirely correct in my view. That, I mean, it captures the essence of the climate problem, or one of its core features. And this injustice will have to be addressed. It, you know, it's broached in every international negotiation where poor countries that now suffer what they call loss and damage due to climate change have to, you know, they try to extract some kind of compensation for this loss and damage from the countries responsible for causing it. And I think those kind of negotiations will become more intense, and the conflicts will escalate when it's a matter of the continued existence of certain countries. You know, so some island states will be submerged in the not too distant future and basically disappear from the planet's surface, and other countries will become unlivable if in one way or another. And when you reach that level of destruction and that level of loss and damage, of course, people will become quite indignant and upset with the countries that have caused this crisis and that have really accumulated a climate debt towards the victims. And it will naturally require quite a mobilization of force to extract the compensation, a payback of this debt. But it's definitely an issue that will become a topic that will become hotter the more the temperatures rise, for sure.
Let's talk more about those global agreements and global forums. The United Nations convenes the Conference of the Parties global summits periodically, and one of the, you know, perhaps the most prominent product of that process was the Paris Climate Accord. Donald Trump angered many people all around the world by withdrawing the United States from the Paris Accord. But in your view, do those types of agreements go far enough? And if not, what are the deficiencies?
No, they don't. I mean, it's very well known that Paris Agreement doesn't go far enough. It falls short of the ambitions that would potentially save us from a catastrophic warming with 3 degrees or something like that. Because under the Paris Agreement, the commitments, well, they are not even legal commitments, the proposed reductions that countries have said that they will undertake will lead to a warming with 3 or more degrees instead of the 1.5 or 2 degrees that the agreement says it will that it's aiming at. The thing with Trump and others of his kind is that they make the Paris Agreement look amazingly good because they're so terrible. I mean, withdrawing from the Paris Agreement and just ditching all climate policy makes the Paris Agreement look like utopia, when in fact it was a very deficient agreement. What's so depressing about the situation is that you have a watering down of the climate negotiations, and then you have countries, notably the US, that decide not to try to live up even to these very, very shallow commitments that were made in Paris and elsewhere. Unfortunately, again, this is the direction we're going in, where you see in Europe, that has long been regarded as the forerunner in climate politics, a sudden resurgence of climate denialism of the Trump kind. Germany, for instance, which has been an avant-garde country when it comes to energy transition and the building of renewable energy infrastructure, now has as its second largest party in the polls the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, which has the same line on climate change as Trump, basically, that it doesn't exist, it's not a problem, and we're going to burn as much coal as possible. And these are the parties that are making headway in European politics, in country after country. And that's, again, quite irrational.
We have just under 1 minute left. Andreas Malm, any final thoughts? I mean, what about solutions? I know we have just a short amount of time, but what's the takeaway? 30 seconds.
We are now so late and we have waited so long with attacking this problem that really radical measures will have to be demanded, such as bans on fossil fuels, moratoriums, very radical interventions into the economies to shift them away from fossil fuels fast. And to get to that stage, we're going to need serious mass mobilization from social movements and everyone concerned.
We're all out of time. We've been joined from Sweden by Andreas Malm. He teaches human ecology at Lund University, and he's the author of the new book, The Progress of the Storm. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.